Welcome to The Environment Show, exploring issues and events of the planet. I'm Thomas Lally. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby from Bennington, Vermont. 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is former Environmental Conservation Commissioner for the state of New York and former president of the National Audubon Society, Peter Burley.
Thanks, Thomas. Coming up on this week's Environment Show, we take a look at how states regulate and create pollution. First, we examine whether permitting a lot of waste facilities in minority neighborhoods violates civil rights. Then we consider whether states obey the environmental laws they attempt to enforce. We speak with Norman Vaughn, who climbed the mountain in Antarctica, named after him when he was 89 years old. And on our Earth calendar, we watch buildings along the St. Lawrence River grow gray fur. These stories and more coming up this week on The Environment Show. A summons has just been served in a lawsuit which seeks to make new connections between neighborhood environmental quality and civil rights. The place is Chester, Pennsylvania, located 20 miles southeast of Philadelphia. It's a city of 42,000 inhabitants, 70% of whom are African Americans. A local organization, the Chester Residents Concerned for Quality Living, has sued the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection in federal court. It alleges that by issuing a significant number of permits which concentrate waste disposal and processing facilities in Chester, rather than spreading them out throughout the larger community, the state of Pennsylvania is violating their civil rights. Patrick Anderson, process manager for the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency in the Mid-Atlantic region, headed a project to assess environmental risk in Chester. He confirms that there are some real problems there.
The city of Chester itself, in some locations, have reasons to be concerned about the effects of and the environmental health and some of those effects on the residents in Chester.
He also says there is a concentration of plants that deal with and generate waste.
There's an awful lot of waste industries that have located in the city of Chester. I mean, for instance, there's an autoclave that handles kind of sterilization of what we would call red bag waste or medical waste. There's a wet waste treatment plant that handles all the wastewater for the entire county. There's a sludge incinerator that's there. There's a kind of a trash incinerator, a trash to steam generates some power that handles waste from the entire area, including parts of Delaware. And the latest one is a soil burner that would try to clean up some soils where there's been spills from gasoline tanks and that kind of thing. So, and they're all located in pretty much a concentrated area in what would, I guess, be the southeast portion of the city of Chester.
It's the presence of all these facilities that gives rise to the charge that Pennsylvania, by licensing the latest one, is violating the civil rights of Chester residents. Jerome Balder, an attorney representing the group Chester Residents Concerned for Quality Living, describes the action.
What we are seeking to achieve is to overcome a long problem in which facilities such as incinerators, waste processing units, medical processing units are all confined and located in areas where black people are the overwhelming number of percentage of the residents, and where such facilities do not go into middle class or upper class white areas. And we define this as environmental racism, and that's what we're trying to overcome.
Attorney Balder argues that the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection is violating the federal 1964 civil rights law.
The legal steps are as follows. In 1964, Congress passed what is now known as the Civil Rights Act of 1964. One aspect of that act is called Title VI. Under Title VI, if an organization such as the state receives federal monies from a department such as the Environmental Protection Agency, then they must operate those programs in a way that would not effectuate a discrimination against minorities. In fact, the department is operating as though it's oblivious to that problem. That is, the department says it has nothing to do with the selection of sites. It doesn't look at what the nature of the communities are. And more than that, it doesn't even look at what other facilities there are. It's our view that that policy that the state practices and has continued to practice for at least 10, 15 years is a violation of the federal regulation itself, because how can you stop environmental racism if you're not even looking for it?
Chris Novak, press secretary for the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection, says that following its own regulations, the department only examines whether the proposed facility itself will meet environmental standards. It does not consider what cumulative impact the facility may have on a neighborhood that already has a lot of polluting plants there. She says state law and regulations make no provision for such review.
The Department of Environmental Protection is required under our current state law to review any application that is submitted to us on its individual merits. So an application for some type of a waste treatment facility would be reviewed for compliance with all of our state regulations for air discharges or for the way waste would need to be stored. And if we determine through that review that it meets all of the technical requirements that are currently required under state law, then we are responsible for issuing a permit to that facility.
Attorney Balder's lawsuit is a case of first impression. It's the first time that a federal court is being asked to consider whether permitting a disproportionate number of polluting facilities in a minority neighborhood violates the civil rights of members of the community and the 1964 Civil Rights Act. You're listening to The Environment Show. Reach us by email at envshow@aol.com. That's envshow@aol.com. You can hear any of the last four shows via internet. Go to our webpage on www.wamc.org/env and click on Listen to the Environment Show. That's www.wamc.org/env. It's not uncommon to hear about state agencies fining businesses for non-compliance of environmental laws. But what happens if it's the state that's violating its own laws? Environment Show producer Thomas Lally discovered an illegal toxic dump in the Adirondack Park in upstate New York, which was allegedly maintained by the state's own Department of Transportation. He reports on that dump and takes a look at how the states are complying with their own laws.
The Adirondack Park is the largest state park in the world. It's known for its wild beauty, sparse population, and as a destination for tourists. But hidden in a heavily wooded median along Interstate 87, which runs through the eastern end of the park, is an illegal toxic dump allegedly maintained by the New York State Department of Transportation. Transportation workers here reportedly call it the Bat Cave because of its secret location. When the Environment Show visited the site, we found containers of toxic substances, garbage, animal carcasses, and brush. The dump extends about 100 feet and is about 20 feet deep. It's also less than 50 feet and right uphill from a stream which runs into the Scroon River, considered one of the cleanest rivers in the Adirondacks. Christopher Robin Healy is the DOT employee who notified the Environment Show about the dump.
I mean, it's quite a cornucopia of trash, garbage, and toxic waste here. Pieces of signs, anything, like I said in the tape, anything you'd see on a truck. Brake parts, brake fluid cans, oil filter containers, old oil cans, herbicide containers. Here's an oil filter. It's another filter from a, I think that says case, cap. probably from a bulldozer or a skip loader or maybe grade all equipment, something like that. It certainly doesn't belong here.
The Department of Transportation is responsible for the site. The person in charge of this area is Herb Steffens, regional engineer for DOT's Region 1. He refused to talk on tape, but said he had not been at the site since last summer and added that, quote, "There is not supposed to be any filters or oil or metal or plastic put into that. That's not a designated dump area. It's just an area in which we can dispose of natural wood and so forth and tree branches," end quote. Yet we found items clearly belonging to the state, such as highway signs and road markers and other materials used by DOT, such as bulldozer and truck parts, street sweeper brushes, and other contaminated equipment. The Department of Transportation said they did not know how these materials could have gotten to the dump or why they had been accumulating without their knowledge for so long. DOT spokesman Mike Fleischer says they are looking into it.
We've had DOT personnel go out and look at the site and did confirm that there was inappropriate materials in the site, such as paint cans and oil filters. We will be investigating. Those materials should not be there. We will work with DEC to properly clean them up, and we will, as importantly, we will investigate to see how these materials were placed there.
DOT could be in big trouble. Tim Burke is with the Adirondack Council, an environmental group. He also served as the head of Vermont's Environmental Protection Agency. He says situations like this often start out as a way to cut costs, but can actually cost the state much more in the long run.
If the DEC finds the Department of Transportation guilty of illegal dumping here, then I would assume that in addition to paying a fine, that the DOT would be required to excavate the entire dump, to then sample the soil underneath the dump to see if there's any contamination down into the soil, and if there is, they'll have to remove that as well.
And New York isn't alone. According to Professor Nicholas Robinson, co-director of the Center for Environmental Legal Studies at Pace University School of Law in White Plains, New York, all states are having trouble keeping up with their own standards.
I think states have a major problem of both auditing their own compliance with federal and state environmental laws, and in fact, I think the corporations, especially the larger ones or the multinational corporations, are way ahead of the state agencies in terms of standardizing their compliance. Most of the state agencies don't even know when they are or are not in compliance. They have no internal audit systems. Many of them are exempt from getting their own permits, and so they go about doing things that towns or private companies or private farmers already have to comply with. I think there's sort of an unwritten rule of courtesy in which one state agency, especially the civil servants, try not to embarrass another one. And unless the governor's office is brought into it, they tend to look away from each other's problems or settle them out of sight.
States and other governmental entities perform so many duties that they're bound to violate environmental laws. But we should expect the same accountability from the government as we do corporations and individuals. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
You're listening to the Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burling. Still ahead, we speak with Norman Vaughan, who at age 89 climbed the mountain in Antarctica named after him. And in our Earth calendar, we watch buildings along the St. Lawrence River grow gray fur. These stories still ahead on the Environment Show. Situated in Antarctica, part of the longest mountain range in the world, is 10,302-foot Mount Vaughan. Norman Vaughan tells us how it got its name.
The mountain was named after me in 1930 when I came back from the Byrd Antarctic Expedition. Admiral Byrd named that mountain after me in thanks for the work I did in 1928, 29, and 30. And I said when he gave it to me and proposed it to Congress for approval, I said, gee, Admiral, thank you very much. I've got to go back and climb that someday. and it took me 65 years before I could get back to the Antarctic.
Vaughn lives in Trapper Creek, Alaska, and was traveling across the continent to make a speech for the Nature Conservancy when we had a chance to talk to him last week. He went on to describe his recent ascent of the mountain. His first attempt in 1993 was foiled when the plane carrying Vaughn and his dog team crashed. The next year he went back, this time without dogs, which are now banned by the treaty which protects the subcontinent.
We, however, giving up that dog part of the trip, went back to the Antarctic in 1994. And at the end of that year, in December, we climbed to the top of Mount Vaughn. We got there 3 days ahead of schedule. I wanted to be at the top on my 89th birthday. However, 3 days before my birthday, I wanted to wait and go. But that's something you can't do in the Antarctic. You have to do what you can when you can on account of weather. So we climbed on the 16th of December, 3 days before my 89th birthday, and then came down right away and came home.
He spoke further about the ascent.
The weather was good for us, except, we'll say, 2 days when we were pinned down on the way up. Pinned down only because the snow was blowing horizontally, and that was a wind of about 60 or 70 miles an hour. And there was no sense in breaking camp. It was far better to stay in camp, and then when the weather broke, take your tents down and get going.
So how long did it take to make the ascent and then return to your base camp that you started from?
Well, you laugh when I tell you this. It took 12 days for me to get to the top, but it only took 12 hours for me to get down.
As a mountain climber, I understand that well. Did you? What kind of temperatures were you encountering?
Sir, going in the summertime and choosing December, the middle of summer, for the Antarctic was ideal for temperature. We did not have temperatures lower than 20 below zero. But what you do have to fear, and you have to be prepared for, is that sudden storm when the jet stream can dip way down toward the earth. And if you're high on a mountain and you get in the jet stream, the temperatures can be 50 below zero and 100 miles an hour wind. And if you're caught in that, you can't move an inch.
So for people who haven't done this, what do you see when you're on top of Mount Vaughn?
Oh, it was a gorgeous day. It was windy, but we could see for miles and miles around. And I could see where we went 65 years before when we went by dog team along the base of this mountain range, which turned out to be a range which we discovered an extension of the Queen Maud Mountains, which Amundsen had gone through. And we went into the eastern section and discovered it. And there, it is now the longest mountain range in the world, called the Transantarctic Mountain Range or the Queen Maud Mountain Range.
Vaughn is passionate about the protection of the Antarctic. He points out that on climbing expeditions such as his, climbers pack out all their human waste and take it off the continent, even though the watershed is the size of U.S. and Mexico combined. Vaughn says it's essential to maintain the Antarctic Treaty, which forbids exploitation of natural resources. It's signed by 27 nations. Recently, the treaty was renewed through a process which is scheduled to occur every 50 years. Vaughn, now 90 years old, is preparing for the next round.
Be terrible if countries went down and claimed the land and took it over, and then they could run the mining or fishing or things like that under their own rules. What the treaty does is to protect the entire Antarctic continent. And the reason I love to go to schools and talk is to reach the minds of those very people who in 30, 40, or 50 years, we'll have to review the Antarctic Treaty, and they're the ones that will make the decision on any new opening up of the continent or closing it down.
Norman Vaughan was a member of the first Byrd Antarctic Expedition, 1928 to 1930. He instituted search and rescue in Greenland in World War II and took 209 sled dogs to the Battle of the Bulge. He entered 13 Iditarods, the 1,137-mile Alaska sled dog race, and his latest finish was in 1990 at the age of 84. He gave Pope John Paul II a dog sled ride in 1981 and exudes a commitment to protect the Antarctic, which is an inspiration to anyone who talks to him. And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. And as we broadcast, buildings along the St. Lawrence River are growing a coat of gray fur. Every year at this time, shadflies emerge in northern New York along a 50-mile stretch of the river. They come out in millions during the first week in June, and as they swarm over neighboring shores and towns, they mate, lay their eggs, and then drop like flies. In fact, the dead shadflies can pile up so high in any given area that they have to be carted away in dump trucks. Despite their name, they're not true flies at all. Rather, they're more closely related to butterflies and moths. Bruce Kahn is director of the Marine Summer Science Program at St. Lawrence University and associate professor of biology at the University of the South in Suwanee, Tennessee.
What happens is when they come out of the river, first of all, they land on vegetation, occasionally on the ground. What really occurs is that the females will land on buildings, they'll land on trees, shrubs, other objects along the shore. The males tend to stay up in the air and fly around a lot, and then when the females are ready, they fly away from wherever they have landed, and they join with males, drop to the ground, and that's where they mate. But when they are on the buildings, they can be so dense at the peak of their emergence that literally every square inch of a building will be covered with these insects. And as I said earlier, they look like medium-sized moths. And so the whole side of the building actually can have the appearance of being covered with gray fur during the peak of the emergence.
The earliest reports of shadflies emerging from the St. Lawrence River date back to the early 1800s. Communities like Ogdensburg, Red Mills, Waddington, and Morristown, New York, have been inundated ever since. According to Kahn, these shadflies are actually a particular species of caddisfly called Brachycentrus incanus. There is a similar emergence in Montreal, Canada, with 12 different species, but northern New York is unique because it's the only emergence of all one species. Its common name originated when people who were fishing for shad noticed the emergence of the caddisfly occurred at the same time and called them shadflies. Although Kahn admits that the shadfly can be a nuisance to local residents, he says they're one of the most important groups of aquatic insects on the earth.
As you get right down in the deeper parts of the river, we have made measurements of as many as 18,000 of the larvae per square yard. So when you're talking about 18,000 insects in a square yard of surface area, something that dense has to have quite a bit of importance to the river itself, and in fact they do. They take a lot of the nutrients from the river water, incorporate it into their own bodies, and then in turn are fed upon by the fish. The biggest concern in recent years about something impacting them has been the introduction of the zebra mussel. And, I'm glad to report that our research over the last 2 years has shown that that's not the case. In fact, in the St. Lawrence River where the shadflies occur, the shadflies have been able to get one up on the zebra mussels, as it were, because they are able to release their case and move it around and reattach it. They actually crawl up on top of the shells of the zebra mussels and reattach their cases and seem to get the upper hand in that way.
Little is known about how the shadfly larvae behave during the other 50 weeks of their life, because unlike most caddisflies that live in shallow waters, shadflies live in much deeper water where there's strong current, making them difficult to study. We celebrate the shadfly, a biological mystery. It refuses to be conquered by the zebra mussel and might provide a fur coat on a cool night in June. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-323-9262 and ask for program number 336. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Thomas Lally is the producer, Stephanie Goichman provided additional production support, and Dr. Alan Chartok is the executive producer. The Environment Show is made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long, and join us next week for the Environment Show.